It's Thursday, September 6th, 2012. Welcome to Session 2 of the Earth Science on the Log mini-series. I'm Dr. Gary Bergfors from SOCOP, the Spatial Ontology Community Practice, and my session co-chair is Nitsong Lee from Midland University. Well, the start Session 2 has had several names. Ontology Development and Application Across the Earth Sciences Systems Lifecycle is the one on the wiki. I use a slightly different title here on slide one, Understanding Semantic Insertion Within the Earth Science Application Lifecycle. As we start, I want to thank all participants for joining us today and for our co-organizing support by members from the EarthCube community, Ontolog community, SOCOP, and IAOA communities. Okay, now for slide two, which is a session overview and the agenda. Following my initial remarks here, we will be very happy to have four distinguished speakers, starting with Dr. Rick Cooper, who's president of an executive director of the Consortium for Universities of Universities for the Advancement of Hydrologic Science Incorporated, or QASHI. His, as well as the other people's speakers' bios, are online, and you can click on those and see the background of the speakers. Rick will speak from the trenches on the experience on the topic of implementing a community-governed ontology experiences from the water sciences community. This is the work with others in QASHI. Our second speaker is Professor Peter Fox from the Pedalus World Constellation Chair and Professor of Earth and Environmental Sciences and Computer Sciences at RPI, Rensselaer. This talk is intriguingly entitled Life Cycle Semantics in Earth and Space Sciences, What's Worked and Not, and Where We Are in a Decade In, which provides, obviously, a historical perspective on a host of evolving work and associated methods. Our third speaker, Matteo Santoro, from CNR ISA Labs in Italy, is a semantic broker for enhancing resource discovery. This has worked with several others at the CNR ISA Lab. Because it's late in the day in Italy, Matteo will not be able to stay online for the entire call, but may be able to address some of the chat questions before he goes. Our final speaker is my co-chair, Dr. Nitsong Lee of the University of Redlands, who together with Philip Murphy and Christoph Janowitz has the final spot. She will speak on an ontology-driven framework and web portal for spatial data decision support. The four speakers will be followed by open discussion as a tradition in Ontolog, which will focus on the topics covered as well as general issues. Hopefully we'll have 30 minutes or so for that. As time permits and as is appropriate, I will add some closing remarks. Now, with that, we have a busy schedule here, so let's turn to slide three. A little bit of the goals of the session within the overall mini-series. The overall goal, as stated here, is to bring together members of communities, two communities, earth science and ontology semantics community, and bring them together within a meaningful dialogue. Our goal of this particular session is to further the dialogue on the current status of needs and work on earth science systems with an eye towards applications of semantic technology that might be of help. We want to build on session one by getting a better idea of requirements, such as, you'll hear in the first talk, improved vocabulary structured by use cases and scenarios that highlight earth science challenges and issues. This might address things like what should ontologists understand about these issues, which is an important thing to have. Slide four is a graphic that I've adopted from one of the EarthCube groups, the Interop group, which is represented by the graphical X on the right of the screen here. That group, working on Interop issues, forged essentially a consensus diagram of what they thought people were talking about in various parts of the EarthCube community. As you see in this diagram quickly, we have several clouds on the left side of the diagram, the blue and maroon clouds, which represent various cyber infrastructures for particular domains such as geology or atmosphere and so forth. The Earth cube effort is represented more in the center on the right, which is the cube in that direction. And you see in the cube several things such as services, brokers, semantic crosswalks, registries, and things as that. Which will be topics for today. So this is consensus diagrams very much within the spirit of what we're trying to discuss today. Slide 5, the next slide, is also from the Interop concept group from EarthCube. It represents a slightly different view of the things going on within EarthCube. I thought this would be good for a background understanding. We can see several stacks of infrastructure, essentially, and applications on top within different domains. It's familiar. It also illustrates something of an integration view where vocabularies and metadata are prominent, along with the implied vertical and horizontal integrations that go on there. And so this is, again, something that I think is a good context for the discussion we're going to have today to advance our understanding. Slide 6, to wrap up the goals of this section in the context of what I've already discussed, given our understanding of needs and issues, we want to continue our discussion in this session about things like services, frameworks, principles, ontological engineering, architectures, approaches, perspective tools, all within a cyber infrastructure and architecture as discussed as part of EarthCube in the previous diagrams. We hope that this discussion of things like semantic technology infusion into shared infrastructure will enable collaborative understanding of the challenges and potential values of the application of ontology and semantics in the earth sciences and the EarthCube effort. Okay, with that, a few things before turning over to our first speaker. I want to remind people of our upcoming sessions listed here, sessions 3 in October the 11th, co-chaired by Christoph Janowitz and Pascal Hitzler, should build on the first two sessions and talking about methodologies. I'll repeat that there are small linked bios for our speakers that are online if you're on the website. And then, of course, as Peter announced, we will mute the audience for the presentations. There is a chat that people can use to write questions and comments for consideration as part of the record. With that, let me introduce Rick Hooper from QASI, who will speak to us about implementing a community-governed ontology experiences from the water sciences community.
Hi, well, thanks very much, Gary. So I want to emphasize that I'm a lowly domain scientist, and I have been now hearing about semantics and ontologies for the last, maybe 4 years now. So I do now know that ontology has nothing to do with cancer, but that's, maybe as far as I've progressed. But the issues, I think, that I would like to share with you is really our experiences in trying to implement an ontology. And an important reference for me, I think it might have been Pascal that wrote it, is on the EarthCube website there is this document called Ontology for Dummies that lays out this progression from controlled vocabulary to taxonomy to ontology. And I found that a very useful way and very reflective, in fact, of the experiences we've had in our community. So let me try to review those, and I'll try to leave you with some questions we're struggling with, and I'd be appreciating any advice or insights you might have. Could I have the next slide? Slide number 2, please. So we have developed a standard services-oriented architecture for time series data, and this is coming from a background of people that have used and have worked with geographic information systems, GISs, a lot. And so we actually use the term HIS in trying to figure out what this HIS was over the last 10 years. The real concept here, though, is bringing time into the spatial dimension, integrating time and space. That was the main effort that was going on. And with the folks from San Diego Supercomputing Center, Ilya Zaslavsky, Dave Valentine, and others, we developed what is a very standard approach that we have, as you can see on the slide, a client such as Hydro Desktop that searches a central metadata catalog at HIS Central that then refers to data sitting on various Hydro servers around the country from various data providers. And there are some various tweaks on this that we are integrating both service providers we have some control over that are the universities, but also many data providers we have no control over, such as the government agencies. And so we're kind of doing the brokering to get the government agency data in a format that's compatible with the university data people who are building our system. Could we go to slide 3, please? And so I just want to leave this slide in the next one just to show you that the system is real. As of February, and I could update this, but as of February, we had something like 79 public services, and this metadata catalog referenced, you know, millions of sites and tens of millions of series and billions of data values. So this is a very large-scale prototype. We are hoping to get funding from the National Science Foundation to start early next year with truly operationalizing this system. But I just want to get across, this is a real system. It's being used. If I could have the next slide, please. Which I guess this is labeled slide 4. And you see the usage after a seminar or a workshop last summer in June of 11. We've typically had people now downloading more than, you know, 300,000 time series every month, peaking at over 600,000, and it bounces around. So this is a system that's gaining some traction, and I think for this ontology community, I think what I can bring to the table is a system that is working, and we're dealing with a number of semantic issues that we need your help on. The next slide, please, I guess 5. So there's a URL on the webpage if you want to get more details about the systems, his.quasi.org. Next slide, please. So if I go and sort of now annotate that initial services-oriented architecture diagram with where the ontology comes in, we have in the bottom left corner the hydro server. So those servers have a controlled vocabulary for the variable name. And that's actually now independent of this effort, because now when people register their data with the catalog, they've got to manually relate the variable name, whether they followed that CV or they didn't follow the CV, it's not enforced, it has to be tagged to the ontology leaf concepts for the search. And then on the Hydra desktop side, the client side, we're searching over those leaf concepts, and then we will return all of the records which match leaf concepts. And right now, the search interface is really quite simple. It's a variable name with a date and time box, and it'll return all time series which meet those criteria. We are working on another interface. This is the work of Alva Couch and Alex Bettig at Tufts University. We're working on a faceted search interface where all the metadata fields will be treated equally. But I bring this up, this particular Hydra desktop client, because this is actually an important aspect of an ontology and of semantics, is understanding how complex the client is going to be. And there was a lot of pressure at the beginning of this project to keep the client very simple, and that had implications, which I'll go into, for how we dealt with this ontology of these variable names. Next slide, please, slide 7. So we do have, and we focused a lot initially on this taxonomy question of where we had a core concept which was called hydrosphere. We broke this into biological, chemical, and physical properties of the hydrosphere, and then we have, you know, broken down further, as you can see on the slide, of things like, you know, under biological properties, chlorophyll, and then there's things like chlorophyll A and phaeophyton are two different analyses that can be done, and you can see other examples of this. So we did have a taxonomy that goes from a core concept and a very broad to successfully narrower terms. Now, the idea of this, though, is we want to serve both the sophisticated user who's able to type in something like total Kelvin nitrogen, because they know what that is, and they can get the data directly, but the person who also understands, I want nutrient data, or I want those nitrogen-containing nutrient compounds, and they may search at a higher level, return a number of different time series with variables such as total Kelvin nitrogen, but also nitrate and other forms of nitrogen. That was the idea, and broadly, this tends to work fairly well. Next slide, please. And then I want to show you here, as you can see, this is just a graphical representation of this taxonomy. We have thousands of terms in this taxonomy, and this is what the interface looks like for each variable for the data publisher has to tag it to an ontological concept. So in this particular case, this publisher called something temperature, water, degrees centigrade, and that's going to get mapped to the term temperature, comma, water, because we're not going to be differentiating in this case on the units. We don't really care about that in terms of our search. So this is what the interface looks like, and right now this is what our data publishers would go through, is this manual tagging step. Next slide, please. So is this taxonomy important? Well, first we have to recognize there's no unique or correct taxonomy. We had a couple focus groups on university campuses, basically for about as many people as you have, people would like to develop their own taxonomy. But broadly, if we're talking about this from a point of view of discovery of data, which is our purpose here, the users care much more about what the controlled vocabulary, those leaf concepts, are than they care about the taxonomy. Any kind of logical taxonomy that they can navigate is acceptable. Now, users would like to be able to develop their own taxonomies for their own purposes because they might like to combine various terms to make searches easier. But this was, I would say, not a first-order concern. What people in our focus groups immediately focused on was what's in those leaf concepts, how broad are those leaf concepts, how specific are those leaf concepts, and do I understand the leaf concepts? This is where the semantics would come in. Now, there are semantic ambiguities that we'd be dealing with, and a good example of what I would think is a standard semantic ambiguity would be between the hydrologic sciences community and the atmospheric sciences, where we both might use the term evapotranspiration, for example, but the atmospheric sciences might mean something which is a calculated quantity based upon an energy model versus a hydrologist expecting it to be a direct measurement from a pan or some other kind of technique. So we do have those standard semantic issues which do need to be dealt with. But within the community, the big thing here is really the leaf concepts, and the taxonomy was not that important, although that was a major focus of a lot of our early work. Next slide, please. So what did we find as people were using these clients, and what makes for an effective search? First, synonyms are really important. So stream discharge is the same thing as stream flow. So it's very important that we enable synonyms. Precision of the return. This is an interesting problem, which I guess we didn't fully appreciate until we got into this. But that publishers, of course, want to describe their data quite precisely in that variable name. But the question is going to be, do we go down to that level of precision for the leaf concepts, or should the leaf concepts be somewhat broader than that? And this gets to be a very tricky question, particularly as we move away from physical variables, which are fairly easy, into chemical variables, and it gets even worse as we get into biological variables. And so this is, again, where the design of the client interacts with the kind of, with the web services that are available and with the kind of description we have. Let me just say that most important to all users for quality of the data is the source of the data. So certainly a very important thing that the client has to do is provide a quick click-through to the source. If it's USGS, I need to find out what USGS is. If it's University of Iowa, I need to find out who is the University of Iowa and what have they done with this data and do I trust them. So certain metadata are really critical. But in general, this comes back to this precision of this return. How precise do we get? And so let me give you one chemical example that we're struggling with, which is if we take the term calcium, even in aquatic chemistry, we need to know, somebody's going to use that data, needs to know whether it's a total calcium, a dissolved calcium, or a particulate calcium. And that is an issue where we're now overloading what was a variable name, calcium, with something which eludes the methodology. That's one example, but this happens again and again and again, and so it comes down to the dimensionality of the search. How complex do we make this interface? Do we do something which keeps the sort of the logical model very clean, for example, keeping calcium simply as the variable name, or do we overload the variable name with these things which make it for an easier search? Where is this done? In what way? I would say that our first attempt here at a variable name time space search, I would say, is basically not sufficient for our user community. Things like sample medium, are we taking the chemistry of something in water, in air, in soil, in sediment, in rock, is a very important aspect. Site type is very important. Is this a groundwater well, a surface water station? And these are very likely first order terms that have to be added. And so we come up with this point of saying, what does the system enable, and then how do the clients interact with this? I think we're coming around to the idea that if you want to write a simpler client, which, for example, which assumes the medium is always water and all we're going to get is water chemistry, fine, write that client, but that we shouldn't be trying to use one client or one very simple interface for all users. That seems to be not working very well. But there is this immediate issue then of how precise is the initial return, what's the metadata that comes back in that initial return, and is that metadata both sufficient for the user to refine the search, issues like how dense are the data, how often is it that the user is going to get a zero return, a null return. These are all points that come in and really influence the design of both the services and the client itself. Next slide, please. So I guess one other point that we're really struggling with is the data and metadata models. Sample data for the water sciences, that means ex situ data, so somebody takes a sample and then takes it back to the laboratory. That's far more complex than sensor data, the in situ data. Aquatic chemistry versus solid phase chemistry, I just want to give you a brief example. Solid phase chemistry, I already used the term total Kelvin nitrogen. It doesn't matter that you know what that is, but that's a term that's been used for more than a century, and although actually the methods behind that term have changed a lot over that period of time, there is enough control that that name itself is meaningful. So any aquatic chemist will know what total Kelvin nitrogen is, even if I'm not giving you all the details of the precise methodology. But in other fields, particularly as we move to solid phase chemistry, those things are not well controlled, and there's not a well-defined vocabulary which combines, if you will, both the thing being measured, nitrogen, and the way it's being measured. The thing I've been saying here is total Kelvin nitrogen. So therefore, you end up with this problem that you need to convey a lot more metadata, and if you're talking to a solid phase geochemist, that geochemist expects that metadata to have a certain structure. It's not a free-form field. The good news in all of this is we're trying to figure out how to navigate between aquatic chemistry to solid phase chemistry, is that geochemists don't expect that the metadata will be complete. They realize at some point they're going to have to go back to the original source. Again, getting easy access to that original source will be critical because no data system will ever convey all the metadata that are required. There have been a variety of responses to this problem, such as, for example, the USGS and EPA have responded differently and how they overload different parts of their information model. So there is a constant need to broker among these different data models from these different providers, and that's an important role that we see here at Quasi that we can help to provide, although it's not simple to do. And so there's a judgment call. How much metadata should the system record and transmit? How much will users tolerate entering stuff? What sort of compliance rate can we get? And what should the scientists really expect? When are they going to have to go back to the original source to get more detailed information? I think we can basically conclude, and I think the InterOp group at EarthCube concluded, there's no such thing as a sufficient metadata profile. So this is a tricky call for figuring out what the standards and practices are within a community and then how you convey those across communities. Next slide, please. So I think this is my last slide. So the ways forward here, what I just said, we can never record sufficient metadata. We need to somehow get just enough metadata to avoid misinterpretation of the data. But we also need to be training our users and our students that they have to read the metadata sources. Often users will assume something about the metadata which may be incorrect. Easy access to the original source for more metadata is really critical in having these combined systems. And one way we think, kind of a crowdsourcing approach that might be useful, is to create communities of data users. So people use our client, and let's say they download some nitrogen data from a gauge in Texas from the USGS. We could automatically track that person by their actions to say, you're part of the community of people who use USGS data. Part of the people who use USGS water quality data. Part of the people who've downloaded data from this particular site in Texas. And so when you post questions about the data, you could post to any of those communities. This seems like a really good way forward. in one sense, from the university side, getting the data publisher would be, of course, one level of that sort of that chain of communities, and the data publisher could then begin to respond to those questions, but also that other users would also be able to answer questions about suitability for use. I think that's my last slide, Gary.
Thank you very much, Rick. This is a very informative presentation. It provides a very useful context for our mini-series and session. I note that there already are some comments and issues on our chat dialogue, which I want to remind people about. For people who have called in but haven't logged into the chat room, we have on the wiki site the link to allow you to do that. So there are a number of people who haven't yet logged into the chat site, which will be helpful. With that, let me turn it over to RPI Professor Peter Fox, who will talk about life cycle semantics in Earth and science and space sciences.
All right. Can someone confirm that you can hear me?
Yes. And your slide is up, too.
Excellent. Thanks to Gary and Mekong for the invitation to make this presentation. I thought rather than going through a large number of examples of applications, I would sort of relate this to what's now a decadal experience, just sort of see how this all fits together as we go along. Slide 2 is what I usually refer to as our mission statement at the top in terms of sort of any field of science, but that scientists should be able to access this global distributed knowledge base that has three attributes. The appearance of integration and local availability is sort of paramount, but also in terms of semantics, accessible in the user's vocabulary or language. And that could be a spoken language, it could be a scientific domain language, as Rick has sort of really emphasized in this opening talk. Or it might even be a programming language and an interface. But we're faced with the situation of heterogeneity, basically what that middle set of text refers to. And in particular, it's important when we start thinking about what can semantics do in these applications to help people find and use data, is that the statement in red is the one that keeps all of us in business, basically. And in brief, it says, when people create data, they create it in a way to facilitate the creation, they relatively rarely think about use and especially reuse for unintended purposes. Slide 3. So I wanted to take us back to actually pre 2000, but around that time I was at NCAR writing strategic plans for next generation data capabilities, and it was very clear that there was a knowledge component in science data that even 10 years ago was very much in demand, but there were very significant barriers, and the barriers were very much around the available technologies and the large separations in the communities that would be needed to come together to actually solve these problems. So in between that time, we sort of shopped around a few ideas, and eventually the National Science Foundation funded us to do a virtual observatory project based on semantics, which at the time, no one was funding semantic technology projects in the National Science Foundation. We sort of snuck this in. And we made some very deliberate choices, which I'm going to relate to as we go along here. We took a use case-driven approach. It was in a highly interdisciplinary field of solar terrestrial physics. The emphasis was on instruments and real data pipelines, so we actually needed implementation, something that was really implementable. We needed other things like this integration capability and provenance, but it ended up that came later. And as you'll see in the bottom line, we failed to build prototypes. It turned out, just because 2004 was a magical year, we actually built a production system in a very short amount of time that's still in production use today. That's called the Virtual Solar Terrestrial Observatory. I'm not really going to talk about it because I sort of want to relate the lessons. Slide 4. Says why 2004 was a very nice time to be starting on semantic technologies, because it was then semantic web technology. So when OWL became a W3 recommendation, the game really changed. that level of, if you like, standardization, and finally people could sort of have a stake in the ground. You know, Project 2.x was out. The OWL API Swoop was viable. Editor Jenna API was good. Pallet worked. Sparkle really largely didn't exist, at least from our point of view. But the sort of the key thing was, even in 2004, it was still the realm of computer science. And what I said before, back in 2000, is there were significant gaps in the communities, disconnects in terms of language and how they conduct their research work that was starting to get bridged in 2004. And back in 2000, I partnered up with Deborah McGinnis to work on this particular project. Slide 5. And these were partly our initial design considerations that we used for developing these what would be semantic applications. So only develop ontologies that were required to answer the specific use cases. And this is really, really important. It was important because we wanted to implement things, and we were using the software at the time. We were generating Java classes directly from Protégé. And we needed a stable software development lifecycle approach. And we also made this conscious effort to use whatever ontologies were available. And there weren't very many at the time. SWEET was available, the Semantic Web for Earth Environmental Terminologies. It turned out that the SWEET in its form at that time was not usable. Instead, we used a number of the concepts from SWEET, but we had to re-encode it. Later on, we went back, and with the modularized suite, we were able to evolve the ontologies such that we could reuse a lot more ontologies. And we were pretty convinced that rules would be needed. They were never implemented in 2004 because the infrastructure really wasn't in sufficient shape to do anything robust. And we completely ignored query. And so this is very much an inference-based approach. Slide 6 just gives an example of a use case. Probably none of you are familiar with solar terrestrial physics, so don't really worry too much about this, except for a couple of things, and that is what we really focused on was not to use a use case as a motivation, but to use a well-articulated use case to actually articulate the semantics. So concepts, subjects, objects, the predicates, the relationships, all the important concepts are articulated in the use case. So this is a short description. It's a very specific use case. So for the ontology people out there, we used instance-level grounding to identify the more abstract concepts rather than starting with a very abstract use case. We found this extremely important in dealing with the domain specialists because they actually knew when you grounded it, what you were talking about. And then we just started to pull apart the use case and pull out these assertions you can see at the bottom there. Next slide. And then very quickly we were able to form, you know, an actual knowledge representation as triples. When I say we ignored query in the actual software implementation, but you can, of course, take these triples as a knowledge base and write a query such as select all optical instruments which have a certain operating mode. In fact, that vertical operating mode is a calibration mode. An example of an inference is to infer which operating mode for a particular interferometer can measure neutral temperature. And so by 2005, we had our first implementation. It was in preliminary production use. We wrote an ISWC paper in the in-use track and won an award for that. In IAAI, got best paper in the applications track and so on. And there's a reference there to sort of the definitive paper on this work. Next slide. Along the way, we had to demonstrate the benefits. These bullets are, I'm not going to go through them in great detail, but these are extracted from one of the papers that we published on this, and that it was really necessary for us to think about and baseline the capabilities that existed prior to having the semantic technologies infused and compare them with afterwards. And, you know, I'll just today highlight item number 2, decreasing the input requirements. So when you go from a user having to select 8 things to get near the data to selecting three things, that's a significant benefit, and that perhaps was one of the most significant, but also with the lower bullet, the broader range of potential users. Next slide. About the time that we were about halfway through the second or third development, we realized that what we were actually doing was taking a methodological approach to development. We'd sort of very much had a software engineering iterative spiral development cycle approach, but we then extended that to the development of the semantics. And I just point out a few things. Some of you have seen this slide probably way too many times, but this is what the life cycle part of this presentation is really about, is underlying those boxes in the diagram on the right-hand side is a big arrow. And that arrow, that circle, is traversed multiple times, usually 2 to 3 times. So there is a life cycle aspect to this. The use case, which starts the particular cycle, is important. But you'll see that through various stages that we go through, it's not until over halfway through that we start looking at what technology we might want to adopt and leverage. And the first time we go through, we will often do it in a very ad hoc way to get a rapid prototype. And the open world nature and the evolutionary nature and the iterative nature is extremely important. So we don't try and get the semantics right the first time. And so this does sort of contrast to previous approaches, which we tried in the past, but this one seemed to work more effectively. And the attributes on the right are things that we have to keep in mind: maintenance of identity, distributed authority, variety of different stakeholders, and so on. Next slide. All right, the gratuitous semantic web layer cake. The only reason for showing this is the highlighted dotted rectangle there really shows all of the semantic web elements that we take into account when we develop semantic web applications. Next slide. So in returning to sort of the mid-decade, this is our approach to developing the ontologies. So the reference back to the diagram, use cases with small teams of 7 to 8, 2 to 3 domain experts, data knowledgeable people, 2 knowledge experts, software engineer, facilitator. And we, you know, sort of were partly picking up some of the best practices from the W3 and also sort of rediscovering many of them ourselves. You know, start with narrow terms, generalized when needed. Review, vet, and publish as often as possible, and not get too carried away with coding them in a semantic web language until we were ready to actually use them. And so we use a conceptual, logical, and physical modeling approach to develop small and modular ontologies, and we sort of continue that trend through today. Next slide. All right, so between that period and sort of coming up to a few years ago, we started to need ontologies for data integration, provenance, mediation for data mining. You know, a whole set of other technical developments occurred. Protégé kept evolving. Swoop disappeared, which was actually a problem because we were using it quite a lot. Concept mapping tools, CMAP, for example, added OWL predicate support, and that fundamentally changed how we did development of ontologies. We could actually do them sort of in visual form in real time with the domain experts. Sparkle became serious, and we could start thinking about using query, you know, and you can sort of read the rest. The bottom line part there is we, as people who are doing, you know, semantic web applications, invaded OWL experiences and directions for a number of years, and I think were welcomed into that community because too often users, real users, if you like, weren't showing up there. Next slide. So here's I'm going to show you a couple of triangles. Really, this triangle is one that we carry around all the time. And to emphasize that with our premise that we needed to implement things, we needed to make it iterative, our task is to balance these three characteristics of working with knowledge. So typically, a pure knowledge representation approach will focus on expressivity. We needed implementability, so sometimes you can't implement all the expressivity because you can't reason on it in finite time or whatever. But at the bottom, the maintainability and the extensibility was also extremely important, open world partly, integrating with other domain ontologies especially. This is sort of our working approach. Next slide. Similarly, when we're working with that knowledge in the applications, back to the semantic web layer, it wasn't just going to be about query, which has been a trend lately with triple stores and linked data. For many cases to answer these use cases, to implement them, we needed inference and we needed rule execution. Now, the next slide sort of emphasizes that it's not always an equilateral triangle. It can be all sorts of shapes. Sometimes query dominates, sometimes inference dominates, and sometimes rules dominate. And I'll give you an example of a couple of those in a minute. Next slide. And similarly, we had to balance in terms of expressivity and implementability. Sometimes we needed to make things either procedural at the beginning to try them out, and we were able to migrate them to declarative representations all the other way around. Similarly, in the bottom spectrum, you know, early on, sometimes we actually started with linked data approaches and simple RDF encoding, and as the sort of the richness in the need for semantics increase, we might move to the right for more ontology encoding. But really, we sort of require that we have the flexibility to move along this spectrum with ease, and that's not always actually easy. Next slide. So between 2009 and 2012, we undertaken some continuation of this work. We're actually now developing semantic data frameworks rather than systems. We've done a lot of work on knowledge provenance, and going more into the application side, we've just finished three projects with NASA on data quality, uncertainty, and bias. And all of these are actually in production at NASA at a variety of different locations. So one of them is called the Multi-Sensor Advisor. The next slide is the use case, if you like. Without going into detail of how this plot was generated, what people who use NASA remote sensing data want to do is understand the time series and the data products that are coming out of the different instruments on different satellites flying at different times for different purposes. This is a correlation plot between two what should otherwise be absolutely identical measurements. It's from the same instrument type flying on two different satellites. And you'll see, as noted there, there's a big anomaly in the center of the image. Probably not many of you know much about atmospheric remote sensing, but the fact that that anomaly is centered around the international date line could give you a clue that maybe that's not what the atmosphere actually really is experiencing. It's not exactly clear from the image, but it's a bell shape which happens to actually very closely represent the satellite path. So what's happening? Well, what's happening because of a complex combination of circumstances on the next slide, which constitute a rule set. On the left is the Jenner rule for this particular detection of this anomaly. And there's a combination of factors. I won't walk you through the whole thing, but a combination of the fact that the satellite paths, one is in the ascending orbit and the other is in a descending orbit. They cross the equator at a different time, one at 1:30, one at 10:30. And even though their definition of the day is the same, these combinations actually conspire to give this anomaly, which previously, you know, users could go and generate these things and start using this data without really knowing. So what we're doing is sort of alerting users of the data, not even expert users, of appropriate fitness for use. And these are the sort of things that are now in production at some of the NASA systems. Next slide. Similarly, the architecture that goes with that, this is just a schematic. These are put up as service architectures. So requests are generated at NASA. They're sent here to RPI. There's a series of sort of, if you like, very Frankensteinish transformations and adding of OWL reasoning, pulling in the rules and the general reasoner, forming the new models, and then sending the request back all in real time. Next slide. And desk down at the bottom there, and we're now off in a variety of other application areas. Some of my colleagues are on today from the CI's interoperability work. We're doing work with the Carbon Observatory, Integrated Ecosystem Assessments, globalchange.gov, ocean.data.gov, energy.data.gov. Next slide. And I just got two screenshots which highlight a couple of things. So this is a dashboard interface. So based on the semantic data framework components that we have, we're able to assemble a dashboard like this. In this case, it's for the Biological and Chemical Oceanography Data Management Office operated at the Woods Hole Oceanographic. On the left are a series of facets, which are semantic, so they can be rearranged in any combination, in order, collapsed, whatever. On the right, then, are semantically enabled widget components, so the map interface down the bottom knows about its relationship to all the other components and so on. The rectangle here highlights, I just want to highlight a couple of things, and that is, instead of enforcing a single vocabulary to be used in these search and browse fields, what we've realized is that with the faceted browse, it's possible to make available a variety of different vocabularies in the same interface. So here you'll see highlighted the CVOX categories, which have been developed in Europe and are a service that are being called from the British Oceanographic Data Center. Underneath it is the equivalent instrument categories from the VicoDemo. And as you can just quickly look at, you'll see the names are somewhat similar, but of course they don't match, but they're really referring to exactly the same instruments. And so by letting people come in and choose the vocabulary categories they're happy with and familiar with, it gets them to the data in much more rapidly. Next slide. And I'm very close to finishing. Here's another example of true data discovery. Because of now mapping to instrument categories instead of instruments themselves, and you'll see a level of hierarchy being expressed here in the rectangle box, allows, in this case, a fisheries ecosystem scientist to come in and search for data which he knows is generated by fluorometers, where the word fluorometer doesn't actually exist anywhere in the catalog or the data source over which he's searching. So this, to us, is sort of the true nature of discovery, finding things you don't really know how to look for. And this is done by linked vocabularies, using, if you're interested, SCoS representations and so on. And these also are, this is currently a beta deployment, but it's in operation at the Woods Hole Oceanographic. It's been used by a variety of application scientists. Next slide. And so sort of rolling it all up, this is sort of our architectural view. You can stare at this at your leisure later on. I don't really want to talk through it. The key is, for the purposes of this presentation, is multi-tiered interoperability, different sort of functional levels from software tools and applications to integrated applications to keeping people in the loop. And the ontology piece is the gray stuff. And the thickness and the type of encoding and mediation in there is adjusted according to the use cases of interest. Next slide. Finally, just to emphasize sort of the framework aspect of this, so the blue dashed framework there and the orange boxes inside it are the things inside the framework that are part of what we develop, and other things get plugged in, and that really is the approach that we are using going forward. So that we can plug in a variety of domain ontologies and so on, and all sitting on semantic web standards. Next slide. So to summarize, we did set out in 2004 to build a prototype and ended up building something that was in production. It was a nice confluence of languages and tools and expertise and the methodology. We did, however, even with modest expressivity, LDL, we challenged the tools of the time. We broke Protégé every couple of weeks. We evaluated our ontology developments and consistently gauged the benefits of the semantics. Maintainability, especially modularization, is allowing us to drive new expressivity needs, such as some of the rule-based stuff you saw in the advisor there. And what we're really backed up to is more than just a semantic methodology. We've got an informatics methodology using information models to really start to to bridge these gaps that existed 10 years ago between the application and the computer science communities, because it's all about semantics. And last slide, and I'll be on the rest of the call, but if you want to see some of the other things we're doing, there's some information. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Peter, for a very full presentation. I'm sure there's many topics you'd like to follow up on from this presentation. Now, one of the things that Nadia Santoro, our next speaker, is going to be talking about is a fuller discussion of services. This talk is entitled The Semantic Broker for Enhancing Resources, Resources Discovery. Nadia, take it over.
Okay, good morning and good afternoon. This is Mattia Santoro from Italian National Research Council of Italy. I'm going to present some slides about the semantic broker for enhancing resource discovery. So, next slide, please, number two. A brief outline of this presentation. I will start with the rationale, then some slides about geospatial discovery service. Then I will present the proposed solution for semantics-enabled discovery framework, the experimentation that we did, and then we'll close with some conclusion and future work. Next slide, please, number three. So multidisciplinary spatial data infrastructures have to manage a large amount of heterogeneous data from satellites, in-situ stations, and so on. The typical environment of an SDI is the one in which we have to deal with heterogeneous resources from different scientific domains and from different and heterogeneous data sources in a distributed environment. So the present consolidated and standard, let's say, solutions for discovery are still mainly based on syntactic matching rather than on conceptual matching. So multidisciplinary interoperability solution should be able to address is the semantic gaps which exist between the different geoscience domains. And this way we will see how conceptual matching allows to overcome multilingual issues as well. So a few words in the next slide, number four, about geospatial discovery services. As you know, the discovery functionality plays a very important role in all SDI scenarios. It is, in fact, typically the first step which a user has to perform for every scenario and every use case that he/she must accomplish. So general frameworks for implementing discovery services are the catalog, inventory, listing, and so on services. As an example, here I cite the OGC catalog service specification, the threats, data server, inventory service, and so on. These are the specifications which provide the base functionalities for geospatial resource discovery. Usually, possible constraints to build queries using such specifications include where, so a bounding box, so when, so the time extent, the what constraint, keywords, and so on, who provided the data, and how the data was generated. Next slide, please, number five. So as you know, there is the need for semantics. In fact, as I said before, discovery solutions usually provide syntactic matching on the word constraint, so on the keyword, but this might limit the effectiveness of geospatial data discovery. In fact, we can see in the picture in this slide that a concept A from a particular domain might be expressed using different terms, different keywords, so synonyms. The same keyword might have might be mapped to different concepts in other geoscience domains. So, next slide, please, number six. We have that multidisciplinary interoperability solutions must be able to address this semantic gap, this semantic mismatch among disciplines. And to achieve this, we propose a so-called discovery augmentation methodology to enhance discovery functionalities of spatial data infrastructures. Next slide, please. The discovery augmentation methodology is essentially driven by the idea of enriching searchable information associated with geospatial resources. Several approaches can be followed to cope with this required additional information. I will briefly describe each of the listed here approaches, so provider-based, user-based approach, and third-party approach, and then I will further investigate the third-party one. So the provider-based approach is essentially is the most straightforward, let's say. In fact, in this case, we have that it is data providers themselves that enrich the resource metadata by adding the related semantic information, probably based on control vocabularies or full ontology. Of course, this is a very accurate approach because it allows to directly perform queries on the semantic content, but the drawback of this approach is its low extensibility. This is due essentially to the fact that metadata repository maintenance might be very expensive and every change should be synchronized in among all the data providers for that particular repository, for all providers for that particular repository. And also this would imply to change present catalog specification. Next slide, number nine, please. We have the user-based approach. In this case, the task of enriching the metadata description is essentially delegated to users by adding the so-called resource annotation capability. We have a catalog which is linked to a metadata repository, and then users who can make use of an annotation service in order to enrich and provide new metadata to new meta information on the metadata repository. Of course, here we have as an advantage the scalability. In fact, this approach distributes the task of enriching large repositories to a wide range of users, and we can make use of potentially higher amount of knowledge. The concern here, the main concern, is the quality control of the new information which is provided by users. In fact, this is one of the main issues for the so-called web 2.0 or user-provided services, user-provided content. Next slide, please. Finally, we have the so-called the third-party approach that is brokering. In this case, we have an automatic characterization from the semantic point of view is executed from existing information and meta-information. This approach essentially builds on existing systems. So this is one of the main principle of the brokering of brokering solutions. So to build on existing system, in this case, discovery and semantic services. One of the advantages of this approach, which the approach is the following: we have a third-party component, which is the broker, that is able to read semantic information from a set of existing and external control vocabularies or ontologies, and then uses this information in order to search and submit queries to a catalog service. So we have that one of the advantages of this approach is its extensibility. In fact, here we have that all the business logic which is necessary to classify resources is concentrated in a separate component. And this can be adapted to satisfy new requirements without affecting the other existing systems, which can continue to operate within their own mandates. Then we have flexibility, that is, it is quite easy to add new and heterogeneous semantic services without having to change anything on the catalog services. Of course, the concern here is that we will not be as accurate as in the provider-based approach. This is mainly because the automatic mapping, the automatic semantic characterization might be, of course, inaccurate in some cases. So we developed a semantic broker according to these architectural principles. We have a separation of concerns, so each component is dedicated to a well-specified functionality, geospatial queries, semantic queries, and so on. Then we have a layered architecture in which functionalities are layered according to their abstraction level. And as I said in the previous slide, flexibility, in which allows us to add other services in the proposed architecture, and then extensibility, new functionalities and or other association strategies might be implemented in the broker without affecting the existing system. Turning to slide number 12, we have a simplified view, a simplified schema of the architecture we propose. We have a client on the left side of the slide that submits a query to the semantic discovery broker, and the semantic module of the broker is in charge of querying the available control vocabularies and semantic services in order to retrieve the keywords, the terms and the concepts which are related to the keyword which the user originally submitted. Using these new terms and concepts, a set of traditional geospatial queries is generated and is forwarded to the remote discovery services which are brokered by the component, by the broker component, when in this way the original search by the user is augmented using the semantic content which was found in the available semantic repositories. Next slide, please. The developed discovery broker supports two discovery styles. What we call the automatic query expansion, which is essentially what I have just described. The query keywords are expanded with related concepts retrieved from the federated semantic services. A default expansion is the translation, the multilinguality relationship. Based on the discovered concepts, a set of queries is created and submitted to the catalog services, and then the broker performs an aggregation of query results and provides them back to the client. The second discovery style, which is in slide number 14, is described in slide number 14, is the so-called user-assisted query expansion, in which it is the user who browses the content of the semantic repositories and selects the concepts of interest. Using these concepts, the user submits the query to the broker, which creates all the necessary geospatial queries based on these concepts, and then returns the results to the user. Next slide, please. The prototype was developed in the FP7, the EC-funded FP7 EuroGeos project, and the EuroGeos Semantic Discovery Broker presently uses the following set of thesauri. Here we have a list. We have the gamut, which is mandatory for the European Inspire Directive. Then we have ISO 19119 Geographic Service Taxonomy. We have a set of GEOS-related controlled vocabulary, the GEOS Earth Observation Parameters, and so on. And we have some thematic, some domain-specific vocabulary, such as the EuroGeos drought vocabulary. Next slide, please, number 16. Here we have a screenshot of the demonstration client we prototype in the EuroGeos project, where we see how the user can browse the set of concepts which are available in the semantic services and can select some of these and submit his or her query. The results are then clusterized according to the matching concept. The next slide, please, number 17. We successfully tested this semantic discovery broker in a couple of AIP3 GEOS Architecture Implementation Pilot Phase 3 scenarios. One is the habitat use scenario, which is a biodiversity and climate change scenario where resources from both of the domains are discovered and accessed in order to run a model for predicting habitat changes in a protected area. Then the second scenario dealt with drought, and it is called the IDO-based Comprehensive Drought Index. And presently, the Semantic Discovery Broker is a part of the brokering framework, which is deployed and operated in the GEOS Common infrastructure. Next slide, please. Number 18. The Semantic Discovery Broker and the GEOS Brokering Framework are based on the technology, which are on technology solutions, which are developed by the Earth and Space Science Informatics Laboratory of the Institute of Atmospheric Pollution of the Italian National Research Council. We develop and operate the GICAT, which is the technology which is the base of the broker discovery service, the so-called GIDAC, which stands for Discovery Augmentation Component, which is the semantic module of the discovery broker, and the GIAX, which is a broker for the access services. Next slide, please, number 19. So we have designed and implemented a loosely coupled framework to integrate the traditional and existing geospatial discovery services with a set of heterogeneous and semantic services. We tested the framework in two GEOS AIP3 multidisciplinary scenarios, and we have now deployed the semantic discovery broker in the GEOS Common infrastructure. Further work will mainly focus on the implementation of new adapters, so software modules for semantic services, and we will try to enhance to the automatic query expansion, which is now quite basic, and we will improve the strategies for the result set presentation, and we will work on integrating automatic alignment tools for the semantic repositories which we access. And thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Mattia, for a very nice presentation on your brokering tool and explaining the virtues and concerns with each of the three parts of the annotation approaches. I want to note that since Mattia has to leave soon, if you have any questions for them, please put them on the chat soon. With that, we turn to our final speaker, who is Dr. Naesung Lee at the University of Redlands. She's my co-chair for the session and will speak about an ontology-driven framework and web portal for spatial decision support. Okay, we can have Naesung's slides.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, our presentation today is about using ontologies to organize and discover and access resources for spatial decision support. By resources, I mean data, models, and tools, including the earth science data and models, as well as decision models, and so on. Next slide, slide two. As you have seen from Peter's presentation earlier, one of the main downstream applications for earth science data and models is to inform decision making. And these data and models will have added value if they can be easily discovered and accessed as useful resources for informing large scale planning and decision making. And for that, we need decision level semantics. Next slide, slide three. So we face large scale planning and decision problems in all application domains today, from biodiversity conservation to urban and regional planning to emergency response. And all these planning problems are complex. Next slide, I'm sorry. Slide four. So these decision problems are complex. They involve spatial and temporal dimensions. They are inherently cross-domain and involve interactions between natural and human systems, and they are extremely often computationally demanding. So for that, we need decision support. But finding spatial decision support resources often faces this big data problem. So the questions are, where are the good data sets, tools, and models? And especially, which ones are most appropriate, relevant for your problem at hand? And whether they are interoperable? Can I find interoperable data, models, and tools? Slide five. So all this calls for the need to formalize the knowledge in decision support so that we can register and automatically discover and access SDS resources. And we could also then encourage modular, reusable models and tools development and facilitate interoperability among tools and models and downstream automate workflow, composition, orchestration, and of course provide common vocabulary for the user community. And as a side benefit, you also facilitate learning in SDS. Next slide, slide six. So our solution is to develop a SDS ontology and also use this ontology to drive a knowledge portal. And slide seven, this project was done by the SDS Consortium, whose members include researchers and practitioners in various earth science disciplines and decision science and planning. Slide eight, please. The spatial decision support ontology actually is a set of ontologies, and the main content of this ontology include definitions for planning and decision problem types and their parameters, attributes, properties, and planning process workflows and steps within workflows, and strategies, methods, and algorithms that are commonly associated with specific workflow steps. And of course, models and tools and data as well, use cases, and other related concepts that would support the definition or description of the above. Slide 9. So here are a few examples of the entries in our ontology. So here are the definition pages for the different decision problem types. Slide 10. Here are the planning, different kinds of planning workflows. Slide 11. Typical steps within a planning workflow. And slide 12. Methods, techniques, and algorithms. By the way, all these concepts defined in our ontology are, they are described with a label and synonyms, acronym, if any. For methods, for example, we have, for all the concepts, we also have natural language description, and then a set of formally defined properties. For example, for methods, when applicable, we have their input-output description. For example, for analytical hierarchy process method, the input would be taking attribute scores or pairwise comparison output, and the output would be a ranking of some alternative design planning alternatives. And we also have attribute defined for methods such as decision type, whether it's a deterministic decision problem, or whether it's for a fuzzy decision-making problem, and so on. Next slide, 13. We also have a sample collection of software models and tools that are used, typically used in planning and decision-making process. And for each models and tools, there's a long list of properties defined for them as well. We'll see an example in a little bit. Slide 14, we also include case studies, related literature, related website, and so on. Slide 15, so the people, our researchers define the each ontology entries, and we have design patterns for methods, different design pattern for defining process step. And after the created these entries, these entries automatically, of course, form a big ontology graph. And this slide here, 15, shows a minute fragment of this big graph. So, for example, it shows a particular decision workflow and one particular step in this workflow, alternative ranking step, and it has a few attributes associated with it, and one of them is the, a set of methods typically associated with this design process step, and one of the methods is weighted summation algorithm. And that method, of course, again, has a set of attributes defined for them, and one of them is the tools and models that are implementing this method in our collection. So one of the tools is the EMDS, SDS application, and for this tool, there are definitions about its input data requirement and output data format and its spatial decision analysis unit specification, and of course all other provenance information about this tool, as well as where this tool has been used, in what case studies, and so on. Next slide, slide 16. So because of these definitions and links within among the ontology entries, on our website, the knowledge portal, you can browse the content in different ways. Of course, you can first browse the ontology in a hierarchical format, or you can follow the relation links from to go from concept to concept. You can do graphical browsing in some limited extent. Next slide, slide 17. You can also search in different modes on the knowledge portal. You can do concept search on the ontology hierarchy. You can search by filtering. Basically, all the attributes, properties we defined for models and tools became the facets that you are search. You can search on. We actually use the filtering technique, and we have. You can also do a little bit more advanced semantic search, where you search, for example, if you search for AHP analytical hierarchy process, which is a method, the search will return not just the definition and pointers to the method, but also the tools that implement this method and literature that discuss this method. And the searches are done by semantic query, and there are rules associated with particular kinds of queries that enable the semantic search. Next slide, slide 18. So, of course, ontology are not just for achieving semantic clarity or for organizing things. We also want to use it to create computational applications. So by that, I mean, this. I'm going into a little bit our future work here. So next slide, 19. And I'm going to skip this slide. Let's go to slide 20. So here you see a typical, one of the planning process workflow, Steinitz framework for planning workflow. And we also see where the entry point, where the earth science data process models, assessment models come into play to support the planning process, especially in the steps where we are doing, we are evaluating the current state of the system. And also, earth science data models come in at the impact analysis phase of the decision process, where we are performing impact analysis on the proposed alternative plans and to see which one, which impact, what kind of impact each of them would incur. Therefore, we can compare the different alternatives. So for all these process models, next slide, please, 21. One such example of a process model is this that's been used in by Fish and Wildlife Service for desert tortoise recovery project. This model is driving the tortoise population change assessment calculations. So as you can see, in this model, we have biologists have identified threats to tortoises, and for each threat, they identified what other threats they contribute to. They also identify what stresses they cause on tortoise species, and how the stresses for each stress, how the stress will impact tortoise demographic change and finally population change. And also they have identified a set of recovery actions that can be introduced to abate the threat. So next slide, 22. And this conceptual model is done by a tiled approach or ontology design patterns, if we put it that way. So for each thread you define, as I was stating earlier, the corollary thread and downstream stress and so on and so forth. And when you put all these tiles together, you have this big graph. And this conceptual model is actually being used by a calculation engine behind the scene to actually guide the engine to perform GIS calculations to compute the given the threat data to compute population change for tortoises. Slides on 23. And here is another example of such earth science process models for non-native invasive species habitat suitability assessment model. Unfortunately, this model is all done, the actual calculation is all done just by scripting. Next slide, 24. Here's a decision model, actually, that's related to invasive species management project that we have as well. This decision model is actually driving our calculation. But next slide, 25. What I mean to say is that the current STS ontology formalized the this decision-level semantics in terms of, you know, defining planning process, workflows, steps, methods, and so on. But we have not yet formalized the models, the actual models that we need to perform the calculations for decision support. So that's where we are going. We hope to formalize these models or starting, for example, the desert tortoise conceptual model. There is a controlled vocabulary out there that's well recognized. We plan to start from there to build an our ontology out of it and recode this conceptual model in formal ontology language. Or at very least, for various models, we would like to somehow link to existing earth science models and use the concept there to semantically annotate various process models. Next slide, slide 26. Again, this is the current status of the SDS ontology. The sub-ontologies on the left are the core ontologies. The blue blocks on the right are the supporting ontologies. As you can see, we don't really plan to develop any earth science model data ontologies. And so far, we have been only linking to ISO 19115 for data topic descriptions, but that's not really granular enough. And we look forward to incorporate or to link to other more detailed geospatial data ontologies for our purpose. Next slide, slide 27. And for models and tools ontologies, it is using all the other ontologies. But as you can see, for the knowledge domain side of things, we only defined a knowledge domain taxonomy, so to speak, so that we can semantically annotate tools and models as saying, okay, this tool is used, say, for species dispersal knowledge domain and so on. But that is way, way too coarse. And as I mentioned earlier, we would like to develop some ontology on our own for our purposes, but also really utilize already developed earth science ontologies and use the concept there to semantically annotate the models and tools that we are going to collect in more detail. Next slide, 28. So with that, we hope that we will have an end-to-end spatial decision support using ontologies. So our hope is that the users grant challenge decision problems once we define them formally. It can provide semantic constraints for the downstream resource selections. For example, the decision problem types, number of decision objectives, about the decision problem that you have, or the spatial and temporal analysis unit and extend information about your project. All these, and of course, the application domains and so on, all these information can help the portal to recommend, do reasoning, and then recommend the planning workflow template to our user. And further, also help select specific process models and data sets to use, and so on. So that's pretty much our presentation, the last slide on slide 29. Here are our contact information. And if you want to see more about our SDS ontology in action on the web portal, here's the link. And also there is a paper describing the development of the SDS ontology and lessons learned and so on. And that's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Kang. And all the speakers, we've obviously covered a lot of intellectual territory, but we're still almost on time. We have about 20 minutes for question and answers. And so let's turn to that question and answer period. I see there are some threads of discussion with Rick and Maddie already on the chat. So we have about 20 minutes. You need to raise your hand to be recognized for the chat, and Peter can guide people if we need a little bit of help on this, if you're not familiar with the process.
So if you had put in some remarks already or had questions for any of the speakers, let's try to have everyone click on the hand button if you want to make a remark or ask a question now. People will be queued up, and I guess Gary can recognize people one at a time. What you need is to do a star 7 to unmute yourself and announce yourself. Make sure Gary says he can hear you. Then do a brief introduction of yourself, since we didn't have that chance earlier. Before you start making your remarks. So please click the hand button now so that we can queue people up. Yeah. So there were huge number of questions, huge number of answers. Also, some of the people who had provided answers might want to verbally repeat or expand on them, because that way your explanations will get captured into the proceedings as well as the session is being recorded. So please take advantage of the opportunity to get things in more detail for everyone. Back to Gary.
Well, I also would invite any of the speakers to ask if they have questions or comments to the other speakers. That would also be a great opportunity to have some crosstalk. Okay, I see Siri has his hand up. Maybe you could start.
Hi. I think that worked. Yes?
Yes, Rick, I can hear you.
Okay, so my question is for specifically for Mattia, but I'm not, or perhaps generally anybody else who might have an opinion on this, and I can't say that I'm an expert in any of this, but I'm definitely intrigued. Actually, have a lot of in semantic brokering, in brokering in general, as an infrastructure service, as Mattia was saying, a third party service, not something stood up by a particular user or provider of information. So if what standards or conventions are there for declaring a vocabulary / ontology or thesaurus associated with a given catalog or a given particular data set, such that a third-party broker could, say in searching for a data source, somebody finds a data source via simple keyword matching or something like that, let's say there's a catalog that advertises its existence, or a data service of some kind that advertises existence through something like OpenSearch, and in that OpenSearching capability it says, here's the URL, you know, this is how you access the service, this is what you can search on, and here's the associated vocabulary or ontology or something like that, what would it take for then a broker to then auto-configure itself to that data source, read the ontology, and then perform this magic that apparently happens in terms of the mapping of or the utilization of that ontology in doing this term expansion. They say simple just expansion of terms or finding related terms. How could that all work automatically? My understanding is that the semantic broker that was being described, you know, for each resource it has to be configured and then somebody has to do the mapping, which seems rather labor intensive. How could this, what sort of standards need to be, are in existence or need to be developed that would allow this to happen automatically?
Siri, Jonah, this is a great formulation. I hope that Matthew is still on the call, but I'm not sure he is because I don't see him on the chat list. Matty, are you there?
It's going to have to be a general question to the audience.
Well, I would note, this is Gary, I would note also that Peter's making an audio copy of this, so that Matty will be able to hear your question, maybe respond asynchronously. However, there may be others out there who have an opinion about this, the technical magic that's behind the scenes here, or technical issues.
Are any of the current catalog protocols able to say, here's the resource, here's its associated ontology? I mean, how is that made possible now?
This is a very good question for this community.
This is Peter Fox. Hey, Sarah Jota. You always ask the nasty questions. So my understanding of the catalog service interfaces right now is that none of them are, semantically enabled in the way in which you were describing. But by convention, there are a number of them. And we've put up a number of open search services, which sort of conform to a schema that matches the ontology to help, in our case, mediate. I don't usually use the word brokering, but I think they're similar enough for this particular case. I have also seen implementations that use annotations, sort of Sourcetool-like services that do this as well, but none of those have made it into sort of a commonly accepted implementation that I'm aware of.
Christoph posted a question about whether you were asking about ontology alignment as part of this formulation.
You know, it's really this voice service. When I do the *7, I lose a couple of seconds there because of this announcement that I'm now, you know, unmuted. But anyway, I'm sorry for mixing questions there. There was one about the ontology alignment that apparently is part of the process done at the with the EuroGS broker. So that was one question, and the other was about standards for declaring and accessing and utilizing associated vocabulary. He said they're I thought I heard him say they were automatically aligned, and I was definitely curious about how that happened.
Well, maybe we're going to have to wait for Matty to respond asynchronously later on to when he sees these proceedings.
Right.
Or listen to the proceedings. I see that Scott Hillis has his hand up. Maybe we could hear from Scott, *7.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
With Chevron Energy Technology Company. And I guess the question is for Peter Fox about slide 11. I had to go back and find it again, but there's a small reference to the focus, at least in 2005, on small and modular ontologies. The question, I guess, is whether that's always the best approach or whether it's the best approach for developing a very sort of problem-specific application or developing any application, and even if the breadth of its relevance is large, you might say, for example, semantic search, whether you eventually end up with a large, you may develop them in small components and accrete them into a large single ontology eventually, but it seems that small and modular by itself may not say the whole story. Can you care to comment on that, Peter?
Your assertion is correct. So the slide actually refers to small and modular for developing the ontologies, but as you correctly point out, when you actually go to use them, the quote ontologies can become quite large, and especially when you do the instance population, so you get very large graphs. So that's absolutely right. We find that the small and modular conforms well to an information modeling approach, so that when we integrate ontologies, so for example, one of the ones that we did around this time was there was a need to integrate a domain ontology which described effects in the atmosphere with a data product ontology that described the different NASA data products and a provenance ontology and express the interrelationships between them. And in fact, the ontology did actually get quite large when all of those components were added in. But the fact that we could sort of swap in and out different components of those ontologies was really important. And if you followed the Suite development at all, Suite version 1 was 13 ontologies. And when you read one in, it would sort of read them all in. Suite 2.2 and 2.3 are up to, I think, 112 ontologies. So highly modularized because people were just finding it too unwieldy to sort of reuse parts of it. So it's also true when there are large ontologies that could normally fit together to break them up. Of course, we all know in this community ontology modularization is still black magic. We scope it by the use case primarily, and it's still, we find it most effective to do it manually. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you. That's all, Peter.
Thank you, Scott. Any other questions from the audience? This is Gary. I was wondering, Scott Peckham has his hand up. *7 to unmute, Scott. Our former Scott was Scott Hills.
Yeah, anyhow, I just, I really enjoyed all the talks, and I just wanted to put a little small advertisement for something we've done in this area, which is the CSDNS standard names. And I put a link in the chat window to our wiki, which describes the rules, the naming rules in the system that we're developing. And I would really appreciate any feedback from this community about what you think about it and its applicability to possibly other problems than the one that was designed to solve for us. I should also say about its use case is it's really for matching variable names between resources, which could be models or a model trying to talk to a database. And with the CSDNS project, we do a lot of model coupling, and we need a way to for the framework to be able to tell automatically whether two variables from two different models are compatible and can be shared. And so there's, as you all realize, there's a whole lot of issues related to this, but we've tried to tackle a lot of them and have a usable system now, and we'd like to put it out for public critique.
Well, thank you, Scott. This community is good for the critiques. So
yeah.
Maybe somebody else has a question or a comment. I know I had a general one for our first and second speaker, Rick and Peter. I was wondering if your experiences are converging. That is, Rick mentioned that the upper level or parts of taxonomy were not terribly useful. The lower leaf levels, mid leaf, or twig levels were the important things where the work was going on. Peter talked about the module approach, but then also mentioned a large ontology like Suite. So I was wondering whether you share the same view about how to proceed, methodologies, and so forth.
Any comments or reaction to that?
Well, Gary, I guess what I would say from my side, just make sure I clarify, we're really focusing on trying to canvas the community initially for how they would like the taxonomy. And I guess what I want to say is the taxonomy is important, but the point is that so long as the taxonomy is sort of logical, people are fairly ambivalent about what exactly the taxonomy is, and that if you ask anybody, if you ask five people, you'll get five different taxonomies because we'll use different logics to organize the terms. So it's not that it's unimportant. Some taxonomy is important, but I would say that it's not important to achieve a consensus on the taxonomy.
This is Peter Fox. So I agree with Rick. Trying to achieve consensus is something that we realized is not very useful some time ago. I will say that in our evaluation work, some level of exposure of the taxonomy actually turned out to be very beneficial in users finding data from classes of instruments where they're, because they do have different levels of granularity. In our case, again, it was very much they had to know the leaf node to find the data. And if they picked the wrong leaf node, i.e. the wrong very specific instrument, they would end up not finding the data for the particular time period or the particular type. When that leaf node was embedded in some exposure of the taxonomy, they're actually much more quickly able to find data that they were looking for. And we recorded a number of examples like that. If that answers your question, but
well, it's a great case, Peter. I think to consider it's when people don't have the precise knowledge to get directly to it, then yes, that taxonomy is really important to enable the less expert person to find the information.
And I'll just follow up and just say the example that I gave in one of my slides towards the end there was an example where multiple taxonomies were presented in the interface for people to choose between them, and in this particular case, one of the taxonomies was hierarchical and the other was not. And so I think it is extremely useful to tolerate that.
I think this furthers our conversation and understanding. It's very good. I see that Scott Hillis has his hand up again, or maybe it wasn't removed. Scott,
Am I still on? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, good. I'm no longer. No, Peter lowered it for me. Thank you, Peter. I raised it again. And actually, I guess it's sort of a follow-up question, although it wasn't originally to the one that the topic you guys were just discussing around encouraging some alignment in the community, shall we say, and for specific purposes. It would seem to me to be justified. And I offer, for example, the idea of faceted search. The facet categories seem to me things that you would have to have sort of uniformly populated to the extent that's possible in order to have a fairly predictable search experience and result. If half of the resources don't populate that facet, for example, then whether or not you retrieve something is not indicative of whether or not it exists. It's just that the metadata weren't populated. It's something along the lines of the need for, or the utility, I shouldn't say the need for, but the utility of a hierarchical taxonomy for navigation. But in this case, I guess the point I was going to make originally, or the question I was going to ask originally, is if folks kind of generally agree with the value of faceted search and the utility of facets and their translation that's essentially an expression of a selection of a minimum set of metadata elements, would folks tend to agree that's worth driving for? Uniform consensus and standardization, that may be a little difficult to imagine, but there still seems to be value enough to drive for that. Again, minimum, not necessarily sufficient, I think was the term that I saw in one of Rick's slides. Sufficient metadata, I would not try for that, but some sort of minimum metadata for a particular application.
From my side, clearly if we want to do a faceted search, we need to get a controlled vocabulary established for those facets. And I think for the facets I was really talking about, for example, site type, sample medium, I think that exists fairly well, and there's not a great deal of semantic ambiguity about those, or at least let's say there are conventions already existing that we could move forward with. I'm sure there's devil in the details there, but I think we have some, because we have dominant agencies like the USGS or EPA in the water science field, there are some conventions that exist mostly because of the work of those agencies. And people are used to accessing those data archives, and so we have a starting place for much of this that helps us. So yes, we need controlled vocabularies for those facets. Many of the things that are not the chemical ones, the taxonomy becomes less important, although it's still some taxonomy is probably useful, again, because of people that are less familiar. To my mind, it's going to be really curious how we work across domains. I've just had the experience of working with the aquatic community, solid phase geochemistry, and there's a lot of challenges there. And I think similarly between kind of hydrology to atmospheric science, I think that's also going to be another very interesting case to explore, in part because atmospheric science is generally so far ahead of us in having developed naming conventions, et cetera. But getting that kind of data, I'm thinking about it like reanalysis data that the atmospheric scientists develop, they use words that we use, but they mean something very different from them, or by them. And so I think it's going to be an interesting use case to try to figure out, as we make those data sets more available to the traditional hydrology community, how we're going to deal with the semantics there. So I think there's some really, I think we're on the cusp of having some very interesting use cases to apply a lot of the theory that you guys are dealing with.
I think we could have had an entire session on use cases and structuring the semantics along the lines of what Peter mentioned as part of his methodology. We're getting close to the end here. Maybe I can jump in to thank everybody for participating and hope that some of these conversations will be continued. I wanted to note that I posted on the chat an upcoming VOCAMP in Dayton, September 15th and 17th, which may be of interest to some of the participants. Some information there, and there's a link to it. I also want to give the co-chairs of the next session, Christoph Janowitz and Pascal Hitzler, for their session, which will be October 11th, a chance to comment on that session and what we can expect from it. So maybe I know Christoph is here. Maybe you can say a few words.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, perfect. Thank you very much, Gary. So the next session will be about methods, and we will especially talk about semantic interoperability and semantic interoperability and how to arrive at it without restricting semantic heterogeneity. So we'll talk a bit about cross-border and cross-domain problems. And we will have four speakers. We will announce them very shortly. We are waiting for one more feedback. And from what I recall, the third session will be on October 11th. Correct me if that's wrong, but I think it's right. And it will be co-chaired by Pascal Hitzler and me, and I hope to see you all there.
Great, thanks. Thanks a lot, Christoph. Peter, any final remarks?
No, it's a great session.
I agree.
Gary, Nai Chung, all the panelists, and everyone who came. We'll see you again October 11th.
Thanks all.
Thank you. That's it. The recording, the full proceedings will be archived and will be available in a day or two. Thank you all. Bye-bye.